Hi, my name is Jay Bala, and I am with the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene as a CSTE AFIF fellow. And I'm going to talk a little different. It's not quite what everyone else has been talking about. I'm going to talk about social media and how we can potentially use it at public health departments. So before I get started, there's been a lot of new requests, especially from our field, from our unit, about how we can use social media at our programs. And they always come to me with a news article. They always say, well, you know, during Sandy, there was a fire department worker who was using Twitter to, connect with the community, tell people where they could seek shelter, all these, you know, great uses of social media. There's a research study that shows how social media could be used to detect new drug side effects, and they actually linked it to FDA recalls. New York City, we use Yelp to help our foodborne investigations by combining that with our 311 and other surveillance data. And then here in Boston/Cambridge, at Harvard, they have a few tools that detect outbreaks, and in fact, they even published a study that claimed that they could tell us about Ebola before we knew. Now, this is the point where I have to say, this is social media. It's not supposed to replace any of the systems that were displayed today. This is an addition to this. It's a unvalidated resource. It's something that is the conscious stream of the world, but it's very exciting, and it's something that it taps into something that we don't always look at. For example, some drug side effects, or I guess Yelp is now becoming a little bit more popular. So the first thing that we had to do as part of the fellowship was we started with the literature, and we looked at everything that was published over the last 5 years, and we tried to categorize it into two things, either emergency response or crowd surveillance, similar to sort of a syndromic aspect. And I'm not going to read everything on the slide, but the important thing is that every time we looked at an article, we wanted to see how feasible it would be to actually implement that at a Department of Health, given sort of our limited resources. The type of analysis that you do for social media is very different than anything else. It's usually qualitative. It's incredibly dirty. There's hashtags and emojis, and it's crazy. But the type of analysis were very sort of binary. They were either something that was happening in real time, they were trying to monitor something and then they published it, or it was something that they were looking at retrospectively, and they usually try to compare it to a gold standard. And that gold standard, most of the time, was from a Department of Health, either the CDC or a local or state agency. So when programs came to the informatics unit, we spent a lot of time saying, okay, how can we put together a process to help them implement a system? And there were different kinds of systems really based on sort of different criteria. And these are sort of the three major questions that we ended up asking every program that approached us. The first thing we had to ask them was, do you want to look at social media in real time? This is usually for emergency-related events. And if they wanted to look at real time, that there was a whole other node of this decision tree. If they wanted to look at it retrospectively, which was actually the majority of the articles, that was a little easier because we could purchase data sets and we didn't need somebody to be looking at the data at the exact same time. The second question was, how much time did they have? And everybody wanted everything yesterday, but if they could have a slightly longer timeline, it was great, because then we could build something out, we could work with partners, and partnerships were so important when we use social media, because what capacity we have at a health department might be great, but employing grad students, especially computer scientists and those who understand machine learning and natural language processing, is just phenomenal. And then the last question we had was resources. And you're all going to say, well, we don't have any resources ever. But sometimes we do. And if we do, we have to look at it and say, okay, if we have resources, where could we put them? So I'm going to go through just three of the decision nodes. I apologize. I was hoping this would be a little bigger. But sort of just three of the types of analysis, and we've implemented them all three of them at the health department. The first one's on the far right. It's for a retrospective. It's something where we had a little bit more time, but we had constrained resources. It was sort of a very research project. It was, and the suggested approach was to collect and analyze the data with a partner, and this was done actually for the Yelp study. This was done before I even got there. It was great, and they found a way to make a partnership with Columbia. They took all the information, they built a tool, and now it's something that's being implemented every day at a health department. So, great success story. The second thing I'd like to point to is it's in the middle. It's still under retrospective. It's the timeline is not quite as long. It's called relatively short, but there was a little bit of resources. It came out of one of our emergency operations projects. It was follow-up to Hurricane Sandy, and the suggested approach was to buy a data set and try to analyze it in-house. So the idea was we wanted to look at how Hurricane Sandy information, based on our after-action reports, how that correlated to what people were actually talking about in social media during the time. And a lot of people turned to Twitter during the hurricane. So it was actually really great. We were able to say, okay, they're talking about hypothermia, they're talking about heating, lack of heating, pharmacy access. What were they actually talking about? That's what we were saying. What were they actually talking about in social media? Were they talking about that, or were they concerned about something, you know, the tree falling down in their yard? So it was a really great way to sort of understand, you know, what we did and if it correlated well. And the last type of analysis that I would recommend is it's in real time, so it can be used for emergency settings. It takes a little bit of time to implement, and it takes a little bit of resources. But the resources here are not financial as much as it is for people. So it's the use of a social media monitoring team. This is 8 to 10 people. They've been trained in social media. They sit down, and whenever they're activated, they actually got activated for Ebola. They sit down in front of a screen, and they have all these tools, and they look and they read, and then whenever they see something of interest, they jot it down, and they keep jotting it down, and they put it all together, and then it goes up the chain all the way up to the PIO. If it's very important, you know, it gets mentioned during a meeting. So sometimes it gets important. But there's all these different ways, and the point of this was really just to show different ways that we could use social media at public health. So of course this couldn't have been possible without the fellowship, the Department of Health for letting me play with social media all day, my mentors, Rebecca Gluskin and Jian Liu. And if you have any more questions, please feel free to contact me.
Okay, well, I will ask a question. Marian, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the time and resource aspects around the investigations that you're doing associated with theory. You talked some about the case information, and I'm just wondering if you could present some information about the number of resources that are involved to do that work.
The resources to actually get the data out of the MedSpace system, they were quite substantial. It was not easy to get the data out in such a fashion because of the very, very complex parent-child relationship. The really nice thing is that now that we've done it, we can share it with all the 21 other jurisdictions that use the MedSpace system. And we also hope to be able to go and create the analytical reports and things like that, which you can then share again for everybody else. With regards to case investigations of CRE, we currently actually have an interesting situation right now where we probably have our first non-KPC CRE, probably an NDM on Oxa 48 in a person who came from India, who was hospitalized in India, came to Tennessee, and then had actually been seen as an outpatient, was seen as imaging, then was admitted, and was found to have positive blood cultures, and then underwent a duodenoscope ERCP. So many of you are aware of all the outbreaks of the ERCP, and then thankfully the duodenoscope was quickly pulled, so no exposure was happening with the document that is negative, and all the resources associated with it. I think the levels of investigation really depend on where you are. If you are in a state such as Illinois, which has over 1,000 cases, the level of resources required of what you can do is very, very different. So you think the CDC strategy is very much dependent on situational awareness of you need to be aware that that's something. You need to make sure that if you find the first case or first few cases, that you're very aggressive in doing the contact investigation around. And then looking at interfacility communication, the more common it is around those things. So it's not a one-size-fits-all at all. It's very much knowing how much there is in your community. And that's why mapping it was extraordinarily eye-opening for us. Because there we were capturing this data previously, but we had no idea what the enormous geographic variation was, especially by between different genera. So presenting the data in that fashion has been really, really illuminating. And so we're going to be targeting the healthcare facility depending on whether they are in a very high incidence area or a low incidence area. The interventions are really quite different. The things that make us raise our eyebrows in particular are things like if there's a travel associated thing, if there's a cluster of cases where we haven't seen anything. And so you put a whole lot more resources into those situations. So the toolkit upstairs, many other states that have done tremendous work, so a big shout out to Washington State and Oregon that have done really, really nice toolkits, and we reference them in the CSC position statement in the appendix. There's lots of really nice resources in terms of example case investigation forms and links to that. So, does that help to someone? Thank you.
Other questions from the group?
Marcy Lake, New York City. I guess it's a question again for either Narayan or Illinois. I'm curious how publicly available this data is.
That's currently under discussion. So at the moment, we the data are publicly available just in our standard case, our number of notifications, but they're not the maps. So the maps. Currently, we are in discussion with how can we best share these data with our healthcare facilities. And so there's a whole lot of work that goes on behind that, and we have not yet got the magic answer. It's really important that the facilities know that in their region there is an issue. We have not publicly identified the facilities, although it's actually really obvious as to which facilities they are from their geography, because there are not that many facilities around. There's only three hospitals in a particular major hospital in a particular area, or one major hospital. But because of the public health importance, we think it's crucial that there is that situational awareness. But we have not sorted out exactly who sees what and what platform we plan to use to show the data in relatively real time. So we're considering our dashboard and things that they use for public health emergency preparedness. We've also played around with some other tools, but our Office of Information Resources doesn't want to use it.
So I don't know, Illinois, did you want to comment also on the availability of the resources to other things?
Sure. So in Illinois, within the registry, facilities can see their own data and statewide data in real time, but right now only facilities can see that. So 2014 is our first full year of calendar year of data, so we're working on a surveillance report, and we would like to present aggregate data so that facilities and local health departments have increased awareness of the situation.
Yeah, I have another question. This is Sam from California. I have a question for Mary. Do you mind just commenting a little bit on sort of the advantages of using this new definition beyond it just being simpler, specifically in terms of specificity and sensitivity to pick up carbapenemases?
Okay, so the old definition came up by expert opinion. There hadn't been any kind of evaluation. It was a very complex definition because you had the three genera, you had four carbon cannons, you ignore the urban cannon, and then it had to be resistant to one of the third generation people scoring. And it is really hard to communicate that and for people to report the appropriate results to us. We were part of the Emerging Infections Program, and we sent down a whole set of isolates down to the CDC together with other states. And so about 300 isolates were actually evaluated with using the phenotypic definition and seeing whether or not they were carbapenemase producers. So there were actually 13 different phenotypic definitions which were used, and they looked as to what was the false positive and false negative rate. And the old definition missed 21% of the KPC-producing Klebsiellas, which are the most common cause of CRE in the country. So that's a problem. So the old definition didn't meet the definition, and it was predominantly because of the ertapenem. So ertapenem is a carbapenem that on the old card, some of which are still used, may have been the only carbapenem that was actually tested. And so if somebody was resistant to ertapenem, they didn't test for any of the other carbapenems, by the old definition, you never had an opportunity to be counted as CRE. And so that was a major problem. The third generation cephalosporin added enormous complexity but no specificity. And so there was lots of discussion about it. So that's how the new definition came up, and then it was clear because it was a lot simpler. We did not actually expect that that was going to be the result. It works really well for the Klebsiellas. For the E. coli and the Enterobacter, you're going to get false positives. Using that definition in terms of for carbapenemase production. But if you pair it with a modified Hodge test or CARBA-NP, that then decreases the false positives tremendously. So, which is an interesting thing because we have just taught our labs to no longer do modified Hodge tests. And here is actually something that is helpful. But the CARBA-NP is actually performing really well, and it's gaining tremendously in popularity. And then the capacity of local labs, clinical labs, is going up to actually perform resistance mechanism testing, because of the implications for therapeutics. So in February, there was a new drug which was just approved, which worked against KPC CRE, but not against NDM CRE. And so now the clinicians have a reason to actually know mechanism resistance testing so that they know how to treat the patients. So I think they've got a very rapidly evolving situation for mechanism testing.
Other questions? So, Annie, I was wondering if I could ask you a question. At the end, you mentioned briefly a toolkit, and I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit on the toolkit and how the toolkit was also received.
Yeah, so thank you for asking me a question. I feel better. The toolkit was really pretty simple. It was a description of what monitoring is. It included things like a sample letter to the workers to explain what it was so that the hospitals could just modify it. It included hopefully clear guidelines about who needed to be monitored, and we offered to work with any, basically the four designated hospitals in New York City. We had those in case there were going to be more cases. We haven't had to use them, but we did work with the hospitals very closely to prepare for having an Ebola case. So the toolkit also included a sample log. It included a sample protocol for how to respond to non-adherence, and also to what would happen if one of the workers became ill and what to expect. I can't remember what else. I listed it on the slide that I had up there for about 1 second. But I'm happy to talk more, and I would be happy to share the toolkit with anybody who's interested. And then we just rolled it out to the four hospitals first,
and work with them to actually operationalize it because their hospitals are need to actually now plan for how they're going to collect the data. And in each hospital, it's slightly different. And then we have plans for exactly what they're going to be sending that so that we can roll it right into our surveillance system and go from there. One hospital decided to do it themselves, but it is interesting. Some of the other hospitals around the country that have dealt with actual Ebola cases where they've been coming from, known cases from West Africa, many of those hospitals actually did the whole monitoring itself and had their employees report in, which wasn't really an option for Bellevue because it had not planned to do that. So we really had to do the monitoring, and now if there were another case, that's what they want us to do it. They don't want to have to do it themselves. They did have a system set up initially with a phone in line, but very few employees actually called into the line. It was very incomplete, and they didn't know a way to extract the data. So it was very not a real option in real life, and now they like it that we did it. We're set up to do it. So anyway, the toolkit is available, and I'm happy to share it. And I hope that answers your questions. Do you have any questions, Mary?
Yes, we do. Thank you. How would you modify this if you had to miss coronavirus?
Okay, well, I have thought about it a little. I think if we had a MERS case, I'm not going to say that we would do it, but I do think that given this precedent, that it would certainly be a policy option on the table. And I think the process would actually be quite similar. I think it would be, monitoring people for respiratory symptoms and fever as opposed to vomiting, diarrhea, and fever. By the way, we did not ask for healthcare workers or do we currently ask travelers to report if they have headache, abdominal pain, non-specific symptoms. We only ask for if they have fever, vomiting, diarrhea, or unexplained bleeding or bruising. We did not want to have to deal with non-specific complaints for overworked healthcare workers with Ebola. Well, it's treating an Ebola patient where it certainly can come along with a headache. But for MERS, we would be looking for different symptoms, and the incubation period is different, so the exposure period would probably be shorter, since 14 days as opposed to 21 days. So right now, we have set up our surveillance system to support the call center, and we have functionality built in to be able to support monitoring, and I don't think it would be that difficult to change it for MERS. But yeah, I mean, how many healthcare workers are involved? It could be a lot.
Well, we have reached the end of our time. If people could give the speakers another round of applause.